Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, Human Physiology, and it is March 30th, Monday. We're going to move along in the muscle chapter. But don't forget, next time, you do have a test. What chapters are on the test? Okay, it's chapters 9, 10, and 11, right? 9, 10, and 11, and even if I didn't say that before, study chapters 9, 10, and 11 because that's what I'm making the test up on. But I think that's consistent with what we said before. So does anybody have any questions over 9, 10, and 11? Yeah.
Pre-hormone versus a full pro-hormone. Can you go over those again?
What do I want to say about that? No, they're just precursor hormones. They're inactive. And then they're converted into an active form maybe inside the cell. Right, like when T4 gets converted into T3, for instance.
So T4 is the pro hormone to T3?
Well, I don't understand the good difference either between pre and pro.
They both come before hormones.
Right, and I don't know the nomenclature why some are pre and one are pro hormones. The only thing is that when you see the word pro, it can be activated very quickly into the active form. So we're going to learn a couple of different kinds of hormones that can be converted very quickly into an active form, and they just have the same name as their hormone, except there's a pro.
Pro-insulin.
Yeah, like pro-insulin. There's an enzyme called thrombin that helps in blood clotting. There's prothrombin. Prothrombin is inactive. Thrombin is the active form. So maybe the pre is even a younger kind of molecule that has to be converted around more than the pro form of the molecule. But I don't know that for sure. Okay. Okay. All right, so we're talking about muscle. So again, what are the four basic kinds of tissues in your body? Connective tissue is one kind. Yeah, tissue. You got nervous tissue. What else? Epithelium. Yeah, epithelium and muscle. So this is one of the four major kinds of tissues that we're looking at. And what is muscle tissue specialized to do?
Contract.
Yeah, to contract. That is what it's really specialized to do. It has some other kinds of functions, right? Like it can generate heat. It helps maintain our body heat. And is that a really good reason? Yeah, because even in this room, we'd freeze to death if our body temperature went to room temperature, because we're nowhere near room temperature, right? So muscle activity helps maintain our body temperature. So those are also minor kinds of things. But primarily, I want you to focus on contraction. It does not mean that muscles don't have electrical activity. You're going to see that they actually work a lot like nerves, but nerves just don't contract. Muscles do. Okay, so here's the general structure of a muscle, right? So here's muscle, the organ. And the building block of a muscle, the organ, are these fascicles. The building blocks of fascicles are muscle cells or muscle fibers. They're the exact same thing. And so if we pull out a muscle fiber, this actually looks like a fascicle because it's made up of some other things that actually look like muscle cells. But these aren't cells. These are actually the organelles for contraction that are deep inside the cell. And the organelles for contraction, this whole thing right here, is called a myofibril. So it's the myofibrils that actually shorten, right, that contract. You can see that every muscle cell is loaded with myofibrils, and the myofibrils exhibit this striated appearance, and that's why all skeletal muscle looks striated. So there are proteins that you have to be able to identify that form these different bands that make up myofibrils, and indeed we can see some of those proteins that are pulled out of this myofibril, and these things are called what? Yeah, you could call them filaments, but you might want to say myofilaments because it's from a muscle cell. And then furthermore, you should know the two major kinds of myofilaments, which are
myosin
and actin, and one's a thick one and one's a thin one. And we're going to learn a lot about those kinds of filaments today. And there's some other proteins associated with the internal structure of a myofibril. So here is just a nice electron micrograph, and look at all the nuclei inside one fiber. So if you were to look at this fiber right here, would you say it's branched or is it linear? It's linear. I don't see any branches on this kind of cell. And that's why we call it a fiber, because it doesn't have branches. It's just a very, very long fiber. It's multinucleated because of all the cells that went into making this up. And I think I talked about the neuromuscular junction last time. Okay. Because it acts like what's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells called?
A synapse.
Yeah, so there's a synapse between this motor neuron right here, and since this is skeletal muscle, that's got to be what kind of motor neuron? A somatic, it's not an autonomic motor neuron. What's the neurotransmitter that is released by a somatic motor neuron? 100% of the time?
Yeah,
absolutely. 100% of the time it is acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter. So don't forget, information travels down the neuron as an electrical signal, turns into a chemical signal within the synapse, and then it gets reconverted into an electrical signal on the postsynaptic membrane, right, which we call the motor end plate on a skeletal muscle cell, because it's very much like a neuron-neuron synapse, except when the muscle cell gets excited, guess what it does? It likes to pull away from the nerve because it moves, it shortens, it contracts, so there has to be additional kinds of proteins that just make sure that the muscle cell doesn't pull away from this Bouton terminale right here, because then you would lose control of that muscle cell. Right? So that's really the only difference between a chemical synapse in the brain, for instance, and those that we see here in the neuromuscular junction. The other thing is, actually there is a couple other things, there is enough neurotransmitter released in this enlarged neuromuscular junction. There's so much neurotransmitter released and so many receptors in the neuromuscular junction that when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, it always causes a threshold stimulus. Right? So a skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. And indeed, that's a good thing, because that would be that's the only thing left that you really have control of in your body. Right? Everything else gets taken care of automatically. Okay, the other thing that's different is, since there is no integration center, also very close to the neuromuscular junction, not only do you have ligand-gated channels, but you have voltage-gated channels. So as soon as the ligand-gated channel, and who can tell me something about the ligand-gated channels?
Graded.
Yeah, they produce graded potentials. What kind of ligand-gated channel is it? What stimulates it? What causes it to... Acetylcholine.
Oh.
It's got to bind acetylcholine, which is the neurotransmitter, and when it does, it opens a sodium channel that causes depolarization. And then there are voltage-gated channels right here as well, right? And every time there's an action potential on the motor neuron, it produces a threshold potential, so those voltage-gated channels open up and an action potential flows over the whole surface of the muscle cell. Right, so it never makes a decision on what to do. It always generates that action potential. So you should probably know something about the receptors in the neuromuscular junction. What's the type of receptor? Different ways you could talk about it. You should know the classification and the subclassification. So is it adrenergic or cholinergic? It's cholinergic. How many different kinds of cholinergic receptors do you know? There's only two. Well, there's a couple of different kinds of muscarinic receptors, but there's basically nicotinic and muscarinic, and as far as I know, in this class, you only have to know one nicotinic receptor, and that's what is in the neuromuscular junction, right? And that's a sodium channel that opens that causes an action potential with the voltage-gated channels on either side of the neuromuscular junction. Okay. And I think we talked about motor unit last time. Okay, so basically a motor unit is just a somatic motor neuron and the numbers of muscle fibers that it innervates, that it controls, that it can cause to contract. And in this case, this innervation ratio is just 1 to 3. So this doesn't elicit a very strong contraction. So let's say that I have these motor units in my biceps brachii. And if I want to lift my hand up right now, right, does that need a strong force of contraction or a relatively weak strength of contraction? Okay. Am I lifting anything? Just my hand. So it's a very weak contraction, all right? All right, and these muscle fibers contract in an all or none kind of response, right? So now if I want to lift a 100-pound bag of potatoes, how many more muscle fibers do I need to use in my biceps, more or less?
All.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I might need to use all of them, right? So more motor units will become activated so that all of the fibers contract, okay? And we call that recruitment. So that's how you can produce graded contractions in a whole muscle organ, even though every single muscle fiber produces only an all or none response. Because in a muscle, you might not use all the cells. But if it's a very strenuous contraction that has to pull a large load, then of course you might use all of the muscle fibers to contract. Yeah.
Are motor units, is that motor unit that's 1 to 3, or are they pretty much?
Oh, no, they have different ratios. Okay, the innervation ratio. Is the number of motor neurons to muscle fibers. They vary from 1 to 100 to 1 to thousands. So for instance, in parts of your body where you want to have very fine discriminative control, like on your hands, the motor units are very small. So you have a lot of gradation in muscle contraction, right? So you can do very, very fine, delicate movements or powerful movements depending on the level of recruitment. But other parts of your body where you don't need fine control, like for instance postural muscles of your back, because what do you do with your back muscles? You use your back for language skills, for eating, articulation or anything like that. No, it just kind of holds your, it strengthens your core body. If those muscles basically just contract or they don't contract, they don't really manipulate anything. So the innervation ratio, right, is much smaller for postural muscles compared to other kinds of muscles that you use for dexterous kinds of movements. And don't forget how to use that term recruitment, right? That just allows a gradation in a muscle contraction by recruiting more muscle units to actually produce more tension in a muscle. Okay. All right, structure of the muscle fiber. This is what I wanted to get to today. The muscle fiber. So don't forget the general organization of muscle that we talked about right at the beginning of class. So here we have, what does this look like? I got a nucleus right here, and I got the sarcolemma, which is the name of the plasma membrane around a muscle fiber cell. And then inside the sarcolemma, I can see these organelles. What are these organelles called? These are myofibrils. These are the organs for contraction, and you can see that there is this repeating pattern within myofibrils, and there are many myofibrils within a muscle fiber, and then within every myofibril you see the myofilaments. Okay, the thick ones block out light. All right, so these dark bands are the result of myosin molecules, and notice that the myosin all line up within a myofibril, but they also line up with neighboring myofibrils. And the myosin is also going to line up with neighboring muscle fibers. So when you look at a whole muscle tissue, it looks striated, right? It's not all homogeneous because these things are all justified next to each other. And then you see a light band right here. This band does not have myosin. It's only got actin. Actin is the thin one, so it doesn't block as much light. All right, so this pattern just repeats itself over and over and over and over again. Now, from this very thin dark line to this very thin dark line right here, that's probably the most important structure that you have to be aware of in a myofibril, and that is the structural and functional unit of contraction. All right, so what's the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
You got to know how a cell works to know something about life. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells?
That's
synapse. And what's the structural and functional unit of, say, compact bone? We didn't talk about that in this class, but that's a blast from the past. And you should know. Okay, that is what? And osteon. I can't say your name because I might put it on the internet. Otherwise, I wouldn't mind picking on you. But anyway, that's what? An osteon, right? All this circumferential lamellae and the lacunae and osteocytes and all that kind of stuff. That's how compact bone is put together, but also how bone functions. So this right here is the structural and functional unit of contraction, which is the sarcomere, and you can see it's got myosin and it's got actin, and these are the endpoints. And if you were going to pick a letter of the alphabet to designate the endpoint of something, you would pick a letter Z. right? So that would be the Z-line or Z-disc, however you want to talk about it. And what protein that we have mentioned is attached to the Z-line right here? Okay? It is actually the thin filament, right, is the actin. It's the actin that's attached to the Z, and the myosin is pretty much in the middle of the sarcomere. Okay? So as we start our discussion of muscle contraction, I could pose a question that you should figure out, and that is, which one of these proteins actually shortens? Does it the myosin shorten, or does it the actin shorten? Okay. Well, we'll develop this idea as we go. Okay? Because indeed, the sarcomere shortens, but not just this one sarcomere, but its neighbors shorten too when it's stimulated into contraction, and we'll see the signaling process for contraction of these sarcomeres all the way from one end of the muscle fiber to the other, which might have thousands of these sarcomeres, and if they all shorten, that means what? The whole muscle fiber shortens as well. Okay. All right, so here is the sarcoplasm. Anytime you hear sarco, you should think of bone. Muscle. All right, muscle. There is smooth endoplasmic reticulum within a skeletal muscle cell, and that's called sarcoplasmic reticulum, right, using that same nomenclature. All right, so you got to know the bands. This might be an exam figure. I'm not really too sure. So here you see a sarcomere between the Z lines, right, and attached to the Z line or Z disc is the actin molecule, and the thick one right here in the middle, that's the myosin. All right, so the I band, so every sarcomere has half of an I band. Okay, here's the other half of the I band. And how is it easy to remember this is the I band right here? Because it's the light band, and there's an I in light. All right, that's not how it was named. It was named because of the way that it manipulates polarized light. All right, but that works for taking a test. The light band is the I band, and the A band is the dark band because there's an A in dark. Right, so that's a really easy way in anatomy that you would learn such things like that. Okay, but also there's another zone. Okay, right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. Maybe this is kind of coming back to you, which is kind of dark, kind of light. It's kind of somewhere in the middle, right? This is the H zone, and then right smack in the middle is the M line as well. So can you see that little M line right here? Okay, you can see the Z here. Here's the dark band, and then the H zone within the dark band. Okay, now you can see that these proteins form kind of filamentous structures, but maybe on the actin right here, you can see that it's actually made up of globular kinds of proteins that are just kind of sewn together. But on the myosin, the thick one, you see rods, protein rods. But what else? You see these things sticking off of them. We call these cross bridges because these cross bridges can actually attach themselves to actin under certain circumstances. But right now, you see that they're completely separated from actin because the sarcomere is at rest. All right, so don't confuse any of these bands up. One of these figures is an exam figure. I don't know exactly which one it is. It probably doesn't matter too much. All right, so make sure you know the different bands here. And if we were to think of this not as just a two-dimensional structure, but a true three-dimensional structure, maybe we can make a cut right through here and look at it on end. This is what it's going to look like. And I think this is important to see because what kind of protein does that look like? We're now where I have the cursor. Yeah, why does it look like a myosin? Because it's thick. All right, and what's surrounding this myosin? Look at that. What's that? That's an actin protein, a thin protein. So surrounding every myosin, right, there's a ring of actin. Furthermore, if you look at an actin, what's on any side of an actin? It's going to be a myosin. They surround each other, right? So they're all butted up against each other. They're packaged very neatly. Sometimes we call that interdigitation, okay, when things are packed together like that. So try not to forget of that arrangement. So one myosin can interact with many actin, and a actin can interact with many myosins as a result of that. So it's kind of a neat structure as a result. All right, so this M line right here just holds the myosin in place because the sarcomere is going to be moving around. All right, so it kind of anchors it within the myofibril. There's another protein that we haven't talked about, and this is the titin filament. The titin just kind of holds the myosin in place as well so that it doesn't wander around. Because where should that myosin be? It should be completely surrounded by actin, right? So if it moves around, it will lose that arrangement. So titin kind of maintains that architecture. And you can also see that the titin sort of looks like a spring, because that's one property muscle has, and that is it's got elasticity and extensibility, which means that, for instance, let's think about the triceps right here. So when I contract my biceps, what does my triceps have to do? It's got to stretch out. We call that extensibility. Even though it's not contracting, there has to be something within sarcomeres that can stretch. So titin gives the molecule ability to do that, right? And then even if I just passively extend my arm, what happens to my triceps?
Well,
it gets shorter because of elasticity. So the titin molecule changes shape, puts a little bit of tension, but it doesn't contract with force. It can't produce force like if you're trying to lift an object, for instance. It just kind of maintains where myosin exists within the sarcomere. And again, here I can see these cross bridges coming off the myosin, and we're going to see that they can interact with the thin filaments. All right, so how a muscle contracts. All right, muscle contracts because myofibrils get shorter. What's the structural functional unit within a myofibril? It's a sarcomere, right? And all of those thousands of sarcomeres get shorter, so it makes the myofibrils get shorter. And do you have a picture of a myofibril in your mind? What's a myofibril? It's this guy right here. Not a myofilament, but an organelle. Right, the myofibril actually shortens. Okay, and this occurs because thin filaments slide over in between the thick filaments toward the center, shortening the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc. All right, so we're going to take a look and see how this happens. So here we have some electron micrographs, and we're going to justify all of these pictures so that this center Z-disc all line up together. All right, so we're going to look at two sarcomeres, one on the right and left side of this Z-line right here. So this is a sarcomere at rest, and you can see all the proper structures like the light bands and the A bands and the H zone right here. And so somebody decided to have this muscle contract. They stimulated it and then took another picture of it. And this is what they saw. Okay, and that is, what happened to the H zone? It's kind of disappearing. All right, and what about the I band right here? It's getting smaller as well, but look at the A band. It's really pretty much the same size, the same width, okay? And then they stimulated the muscle maximally, and indeed, did the sarcomere get shorter from Z line to Z line? Absolutely. Now what happened to the light band? It's gone. It's completely gone. Right, and the H zone is completely gone. All right, and from this they deduced how muscle contracts. So it actually was some really nifty experiments. All right, so let's now go to an illustration and in your mind figure out what the length of this molecule is. So what molecule am I pointing at? This is the actin. Okay, so that's an actin molecule. Now let's look at a partially contracted sarcomere. What's the difference in length of this actin from case one, relaxed, to partially contracted here? I don't see much difference. So it's not shortening. It's not contracting. But let's just double check one more case. Let's look at a muscle when it's fully contracted. Let's look at this length of actin right here in the third case compared to where it was when it was at rest. And it looks like it's the same length. So guess what? We can't say that a sarcomere shortens because the actin shortens, because now we have evidence from these micrographs that it really doesn't shorten. All right, what about myosin? So that means, well, maybe myosin shortens that causes the sarcomere to get shorter. Well, let's look at rest, all right, and then we look where it's partially contracted, and you'll say, looks pretty much the same length. Now let's look when it's fully contracted, and we see what? That's the same length as when it's relaxed. All right, so I don't see any proteins that shorten when muscle contracts. But nonetheless, things do change within the sarcomere, right? These I bands go away. So how could you explain that?
They overlap.
They overlap, right? And the filaments slide past each other. So we call that the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. Right? So if we have two filaments right here, actin and myosin, we've got these two markers. And can I make these markers get any shorter? No, right? They're pretty rigid. So if I put them end to end, if I put them end to end, maybe I'll have to stick them together. Put them end to end, and my hands are kind of far apart, whatever that is. Maybe that's a foot or something. Okay. But then if I let the markers slide over each other, okay, what's the distance between my hands? That's a lot. It changed, and it's a lot shorter, right? But what about the length of these markers? Didn't change. They only slid over each other. So that's actually how a sarcomere works as well. Actin and myosin slide over each other, bringing the Z-discs together. And we're going to see that it's those cross bridges on myosin that can attach to the actin, and they pull the actin toward the middle of the sarcomere on the left-hand side, and they pull the actin on the right-hand side toward the center, thereby pulling the Z lines together when a muscle contracts. Okay. So what do we call that? We call that the sliding filament model of contraction. If you want to call that a theory, that's fine with me. All right. So I just talked about all this stuff right here, so I'm not going to read that slide to you. All right. So how does that happen? Well, let's really zoom in to actin and myosin. So here we have the thick filament. Here's the thin filament. These have different things that we can't always see with an electron microscope on it. Here are the cross bridges. So a cross bridge, all right, it's got a head group. So this little bubble right here is the head group. And then here is the myosin tail that attaches it to the major part of the myosin molecule. The myosin head group has got a couple interesting sites on it. It's got a binding site for ATP. So here we can see an ATP molecule stuck into it. But not just a binding site, this also acts as an ATPase. So what does an ATPase do? It breaks down ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate, all right? And then it uses that energy for some purpose, maybe a conformation change. It changes a conformation of the myosin head group right here. And indeed, you see a conformation change. This acts like a little joint right here. So this looks flexed, and this kind of looks extended over here, so the myosin head can change conformation depending on if it has energy from ATP. The other site is right on the top of the head group. This is an actin binding site, which means what? It can bind to actin. And you see an actin in the neighborhood right here. Okay. All right, so that's pretty much it for myosin. This ATPase in skeletal muscle is very fast, which means what? You can contract muscles very rapidly. We're going to see some other muscles that just won't contract with a lot of speed because they don't have fast-acting myosin. They have slow myosin. All right. Now let's turn our attention to actin right here. We see that it has two chains made of G-actin, which is what, globular actin right here, but it has some other molecules that are associated with it. These long filamentous molecules are called tropomyosin, and then there's a shorter molecule that's associated with tropomyosin called troponin. And I'll give you a hint of what troponin does. It has a cousin molecule, or sister molecule, that you're already familiar with, and it's called calmodulin. What does calmodulin interact with?
Calcium.
That's right. So troponin can bind calcium. It interacts with calcium, and when it does, it changes conformation. And since it's associated with tropomyosin, guess what? It causes a change in the conformation of tropomyosin as well, right? And when that happens, we're going to see what happens to this cross bridge between the myosin and the actin filament. Okay. So myosin, when the cell is at rest, can't bind to actin, right? Unless it's been cocked by ATP, gone through this conformation change. All right, so that means that myosin has to be in this extended configuration right here. So ATP, that almost looks like ADP. I'm not familiar with these colors. All right, but when it binds ATP, it straightens out. Okay, when ATP is hydrolyzed into ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, and when that happens, myosin can bind to an actin under certain circumstances. And I have to tell you when those circumstances are in just a little bit. All right. And then when inorganic phosphate is released from the head group right here, guess what happens to the shape of this crossbridge? It changes. It goes back to this flexed condition, right? And when it does, what happens to this actin molecule? It gets pulled to the right when that happens, right? And so the actin and myosin are going to slide past each other. So this is what we call the power stroke. When the myosin head group is bound to the actin and it goes back to this flexed kind of position right here, that happens when inorganic phosphate is released from the active site on the myosin head group. So inorganic phosphate release causes the power stroke. And this can happen thousands of times a second, right, on this myosin head group. But how many head groups does a myosin have? Thousands, right? And they're all operating thousands of times a second. But is it just one myosin with one actin? Nope. It's this one myosin surrounded by a whole handful of actin molecules. All those head groups are grabbing actin and making it slide over the myosin molecule. So muscles can actually generate a lot of force as a result of that. So when the myosin head group goes through this conformation change, we call that the power stroke. All right, so the power stroke takes place after myosin attaches to actin, and it can only happen after inorganic phosphate is released. All right, and ADP is still going to be attached to the myosin head group. Okay, so here is the whole cycle for what we call cross-bridge cycling. Okay, let's see, where should we start? Let's start step five. That might be a good place to start, okay? And what do we see? We see ATP just binding to the myosin head group. And when ATP binds to the myosin head group, it actually lets go of the actin molecule. Okay? All right, so what kind of enzymatic activity does the myosin head group have? It has ATPase. Okay? So it's going to hydrolyze ATP. What does it use that energy for? To cause a conformation change in the myosin head group. All right, so now it's going to straighten out. So it has now absorbed that energy that was in ATP, and what's left over? ADP and inorganic phosphate. They're still bound to the myosin head group. All right, after that conformation change, under certain circumstances, now the myosin head group can attach itself to the actin molecule. All right, so that's after what? Hydrolysis of ATP. It can attach itself to the actin molecule. Inorganic phosphate is going to be released. Now what happens? The power stroke. Okay, the power stroke takes place. That means it goes from extended to a flexed position. So it flexes, that's the power stroke. And after the power stroke, then ADP is released. Right? And when it goes through the power stroke, the actin gets pulled to the center of the sarcomere. All right, but don't forget this is happening, what, thousands of times and in all directions around the myosin molecule. And when ADP leaves, then that allows for ATP to come into the active site. Okay? When ATP joins the active site, that's when the myosin is released from actin. Okay? So what do you need ATP for? Okay, actually the release of myosin from actin, which is what we see right here. All right, so as a matter of fact, without ATP, when a muscle cell runs out of ATP, what state do we find it in? All the myosin is attached to actin molecules. All right, and if myosin is all the myosin head groups are attached to actin, what does it look like? It's actually contracted. Right, and that's how we explain rigor mortis, why somebody after maybe a half hour or an hour of passing away, when their cells use up all that ATP, right, when those cells use up ATP, what can't happen? Muscles can't relax as a result of that because the myosin head group is attached to the actin molecule. Okay, and then of course those muscles eventually relax when all of those proteins degrade. Okay, so that's a rigor mortis. All right, so ATP binds, it's hydrolyzed, that puts it back into the extended conformation, and when it's extended like that, it can attach to the actin again, all right, and then when inorganic phosphate is released, it goes through the power stroke, And then after the power stroke, ADP is released. ATP can bind again, which then releases. And then when ATP is hydrolyzed, it can associate with the actin and go through that whole process over and over and over again. Okay? All right, so maybe a couple of the important things to know. What causes the power stroke? It's the release of inorganic phosphate. All right, but that energy comes from, of course, ATP, and that energy is stored in what? The conformation of that myosin head group until inorganic phosphate is released. So that's sort of interesting to see that. All right, so how do we control contraction? Because we said it's under voluntary control. Well, we have to look at some of these proteins again in a little bit more detail. You have the G-actin, the globular actins that are all put together to form these filaments. And then lying on top of the G-actins is this long tropomyosin molecule. And it's kind of fortunate that they named it that way, and I'll tell you why in a second. And then the troponin is what? Associated with the tropomyosin. And troponin is kind of similar to calmodulin, which likes to bind calcium. All right, so if you have troponin, how you can remember this is troponin and this is tropomyosin?
It's long like the word.
It's long like the word. That's perfect. Okay, that will get us through the next month anyway, and maybe even for a couple years. Right, tropomyosin is this big, long molecule, and it's covering something up. All right, without calcium, tropomyosin we see in this configuration right here, and underneath, the tropomyosin is going to be a myosin binding site. All right, so when the muscle is at rest, the tropomyosin covers up the myosin binding site, so myosin can't bind to actin. But when calcium is present, calcium is going to bind to troponin, going to cause a conformation change in troponin, which causes a conformation change in tropomyosin, and it gets pulled up out of the way. And then it reveals the binding sites for the myosin head groups on these G-actin molecules. All right, so the calcium is a signal for muscle contraction because it causes eventually this change in tropomyosin. All right, so in relaxed muscle, tropomyosin blocks the binding sites for on actin so that cross bridges can't occur. All right, this occurs when calcium levels are way below, right, 10 to the minus 6 molar, which is normally what's found in skeletal muscles. The muscle is going to be relaxed. Contraction can only occur when binding sites are exposed. I don't know, can you see them under there? That might be kind of hard to see. Okay. So here's a little bit different illustration. When calcium levels rise, they bind to troponin. Okay. And here, can you see a little binding site here? And here and here? They're covered up because there's no calcium on troponin. When calcium binds to troponin, look at that, tropomyosin moves way out of the way, and now the actin binding site on myosin can bind to the myosin binding site on actin. And cross-bridge cycling can take place if you follow that previous scheme. All right, so for instance, here PI has been released, and what does that cause? It's causing this myosin head group to go from an extended position to this flexed one right here. That's what we call the power stroke, okay? And then, as long as calcium is high in the cytoplasm of the cell, or within that myofibril, what can happen? That ADP is going to get out, ATP is going to join the head group. What happens when ATP binds to the binding site? It is released from the actin, okay? And then that ATP is hydrolyzed, and that then extends the myosin head group again, and it can bind to the next area right here on the actin. And then when inorganic phosphate is released, that's going to slide the filament over one more step, and that process is going to happen thousands of times a second, so this actin is going to be completely pulled in toward the center of the sarcomere. Okay? So don't forget about troponin, tropomyosin, and so what molecule, what signaling molecule, or what ion is necessary for muscle contraction? Calcium. What else have you seen calcium good for? What's it used for? Oh, it can be used for second messengers, for hormone action. All right. Okay, what else? It is used for synaptic transmission because calcium is involved in the fusion of synaptic vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. So calcium is used in many, many places of your body, right, including muscle contraction. And again, that kind of underscores why osteoporosis can happen when somebody doesn't have proper dietary intake of calcium, right? Or as we get older, our bodies have the osteoclastic activity kind of overruns the osteoblastic activity in bones, right? Because we have a harder time absorbing calcium from our diet. So if you were controlling calcium in your body, where would you have it go? Would you have it go into bones to make bones strong? Or would you keep it around in the plasma so that you had synaptic transmission? Or would you put it in muscle so that muscles can contract? I mean, it's a very difficult kind of balancing act your body has to go through as we get older to maintain proper calcium. And probably the last place where you need to have it is in your bones. Okay, because what do you need muscles for? Like breathing. Okay, can't even breathe without proper calcium. As a matter of fact, these signals for inspiration couldn't even reach the diaphragm for the diaphragm to contract without the proper levels of calcium. Okay. So where does that calcium signal come from? That's what we want to talk about now. All right, so now you know the filaments, how they work, the cross bridges, and troponin, tropomyosin, waiting for that calcium signal. Where does that calcium signal come from? And, yeah, it comes from that smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which we call the sarcoplasmic reticulum inside a muscle cell. All right, and so this network right here that surrounds every myofibril, that's the smooth, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and it probably has a nice color, like is, I don't know, is it pink or something? No. What color? Oh, you can't tell, yeah, that's good. What color does it look like? Beige? Nondescript color. Nobody wants to tell me.
Aqua.
Aqua. So, all right, so it's a cross between orange and aqua right here. Aqua. Aqua. Aqua is what? Green and blue together. Okay, green and blue right here. So these are the object. This is the object right here that has, that acts as a reservoir for calcium. Okay, so there's super high calcium inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So if we were to figure out a way to open up the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which way would calcium flow?
Into
the cytoplasm or around all of the myofilaments in this myofibril. It would rush out from high concentration to low out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. There just has to be a way to do that because calcium doesn't like to go through any kind of membrane by itself, right? Because it is hydrophilic. It can't get through any kind of membrane, and that's what makes up the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so how does that happen? Well, there's another structure we have to look at. So here is the sarcolemma, which is the cell membrane. Notice that every once in a while, there's a tunnel that goes right to the interior of the muscle cell, and it surrounds every myofibril. All right, so actually you should think of these as continuations of the cell membrane. These are what we call transverse tubules because they are what? Transverse to the long axis of the muscle cell, a T-tubule. And just like a neuron cell membrane, there are voltage-gated channels on the sarcolemma, and they're voltage-gated channels within the T-tubules. So that means muscle cells can propagate what? If they have sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels, they can propagate action potentials without decrement, right, over the whole muscle cell. And those action potentials don't just sweep over the surface of the cell, but they do what? They get transmitted to the deep interior parts of the muscle fiber cell because of the T-tubules, right? All right, so that's how the electrical signal gets into the muscle fiber. And on either side of the T-tubule, we see these enlargements. We call these the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's a special part of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It's still loaded with calcium right here on either side. So sometimes we call this structure right here of one T-tubule and these two terminal cisternae, we call that a triad. That might be ringing a bell from anatomy. Okay. Okay, so we're kind of getting someplace. So here is an enlarged view of a muscle cell. We see what the neuromuscular junction right here. So action potentials come down. And when a voltage changes here, that what opens up a voltage-gated calcium channel that causes release of neurotransmitter, neurotransmitter, namely what? Acetylcholine. So these are nicotinic receptors then that open up. That allows for depolarization of the motor end plate. And within the motor end plate, there are also voltage-gated channels that open for sodium. So sodium enters the cell, depolarizing the cell. And there are voltage-gated channels everywhere. So that action potential is propagated over the whole sarcoplasm, sarcolemma, as well as T-tubules right here. So it goes down the T-tubule. What's on either side of the T-tubule? Yeah, the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And don't forget, what are these little molecules here? What is the sarcoplasmic, the job of the sarcoplasmic reticulum? It's a, yeah, its job is to gobble up calcium from the cell, so there are calcium ATP pumps that are working constantly, right, just shoving every little last bit of calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But when an action potential runs down through a T-tubule, it bumps into another kind of receptor in the T-tubule. We call that a DHP receptor. It's a dihydropyridine receptor, and it is coupled to another receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, and that's a ryanodine receptor. And this is a, yeah.
The DHP receptor is number 3 on there.
Where's three? Here.
Yeah.
Here's a three right here.
That's the DHP
receptor. Hopefully it's nicely color-coded for you. So is this one the same color as this one here? Yeah. Which is different than this one here? Okay. Should be a little bit different color. Maybe a different color than this one. This one should just probably be, what, a plain old voltage-gated channel that's going to further propagate the action potential down the T-tubule. This is an interesting receptor right here because notice it's touching another receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. This is a mechanical receptor. When it changes conformation, guess what it does? It pulls on the receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, causing it to open. And guess what kind of channel opens then? A calcium channel. And then calcium quickly floods out into the myofibril, all right, and binding to troponin, which then gets tropomyosin out of the way so that the cross bridges can work and then the filaments slide over each other. All right. And when, so this mechanical receptor is called a ryanodine receptor. All right. So it's not a voltage receptor. It's just, for instance, it's kind of a very simple analogy. If that door were closed and you wanted to get out, what would you do to it? Would you have to shock it with a battery? No. All you do is push on it. And that's what this kind of receptor does, right? It's just a mechanical receptor. And then calcium can leave. And then there are other receptors, other channels, that are called calcium-induced calcium release channels. So once a little bit of calcium gets into the myofibril, it causes even bigger calcium channels to open up, kind of like a positive feedback mechanism, right? And these calcium-induced calcium release channels are 10 times the size of normal ion channels, so there's a huge flood of calcium, not just into the area right around the terminal cisternae, but where? All throughout the myofibril, flooding calcium signal between every little myosin and actin molecule, causing cross bridges to cycle. Okay, so the DHP receptors are in the transverse tubule, the ryanodine and calcium-induced channels are in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so this mechanism that we talked about, and I guess I talked about all this stuff already. I don't know why I have two slides right here. This is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. All right, so what is that? What is excitation is? What? Excitation of a, when a neurotransmitter binds to this nicotinic receptor that causes depolarization, right? That's your typical EPSP. And then how is that coupled to sliding of the filaments? Well, that always produces an action potential because it's a massive depolarization. That action potential is propagated down the T-tubule, and then the DHP receptors pull on the ryanodine receptors that open up calcium channels, and then those channels cause even more calcium-induced channels to open up, which floods the whole myofibril with calcium, which then gets tropomyosin out of the way so that the head group can bind to actin, and if there's ATP, then cross-bridge cycling can take place. So, does that sound kind of like a wordy proposition?
Yeah.
Yes. All right, which means, and maybe you measured this in lab, from the time when you stimulate a muscle, right, to the time when it starts to contract, is that exactly the same period of time?
No.
It's not. What do we call that period of time? Anybody remember? Starts with an L. That's the latent period, right? Because things have to happen. That calcium has to flood out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and all these things are connected together. But nonetheless, it's still really fast, right? But there's, if you have an oscilloscope, you can measure that latent period. All right, so here is a nice flow diagram of what I just talked about so far. But you should probably look this over. Make sure maybe you can duplicate this flow diagram, at least for sure in your mind. All right, because it goes through all these steps. And you know what diffusion entering, I mean, sodium diffusing into the cell is called. That's what? That's a typical EPSP. And in skeletal muscle, that always reaches threshold. That's always going to produce an action potential because skeletal muscles can never make up their own mind whether they're going to contract. And they have just a single innervation, and that's from a somatic motor neuron. All right, unlike some other kind of muscles that you already know about that have dual innervation. What kind of muscles have dual innervation?
Heart.
Like heart, cardiac muscle? And when I say dual innervation, what kind of, that means two. What two nerves go to the heart? Yeah, sympathetic and parasympathetic, and maybe Wednesday you probably want to know a little bit about that a little bit. Okay? Okay. But skeletal muscle, that's not true. All right. And then when that action potential goes away, the calcium ATPases in the sarcoplasmic reticulum start pumping all that calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so then when those ATPases take over, the calcium ATPases load all the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, what happens to cross-bridge cycling?
Stop.
It kind of stops because tropomyosin then covers up the binding sites for myosin, and since myosin can't grab hold of actin anymore, then the filaments start to relax because, remember, muscle is, what, elastic? It goes back and relaxes. Okay. And so calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so I don't know. I thought I talked about that fairly coherently, but it was fast. So who's got a question? No question? Maybe you've heard of all that before. I'm not sure, depending on what level in anatomy you got to. But don't confuse troponin with tropomyosin. You should probably relate it to calmodulin. What molecule that we've looked at so far is related to calmodulin? Is it actin, myosin, troponin? It's troponin, right? Yeah, troponin.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So in that, when you have that cycle, when the ATP rebinds to the site again,
okay,
that sort of binding of ATP is what's needed to start the cycle over. Is that how you say that?
Yeah, it causes, when ATP binds, it causes the release of myosin from actin.
Relaxed.
So that's a...
That's
like
relaxed.
Okay.
Like number five on there is the relaxed state.
Yeah. And then, so the myosin head group is flexed. When ATP is hydrolyzed, then it gets cocked again.
Right.
And it keeps that energy, all right, all through this process right here until inorganic phosphate's released, and then it goes through the power stroke. So what are some of the intermediate steps? Well, when ATP binds and it's hydrolyzed, that's when it gets cocked, and then it can bind to actin again after hydrolysis.
So ATP causes the muscle to kind of relax in a way.
I don't know if I could really say that, but it's sort of an interesting perspective, yeah, because you need ATP to unbind, right? Myosin from actin.
And that's when it's relaxed, when it's unbound.
When it's unbound, it's relaxed. And if it can't unbind, then it's going to remain in a contracted state, even though there's no ATP being produced in that cell, like when the cell is dead. Okay.
So in rigor mortis, you said everything it just never relaxes the muscle.
The muscle never relaxes because the ATP is all used up, and ATP is necessary for myosin and actin to release each other. And probably what you need most of your ATP in your body for is just to run the sodium and potassium pumps to maintain cell membrane potential. But you see you need it for other purposes here too, like for sequestering calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so all your cellular processes just gobble up ATP like crazy. And you really only have that one organelle that can make enough ATP to keep that cell alive, and that is
mitochondria,
because it has what? Oxidative phosphorylation if oxygen is present. So again, how much ATP do you need a day to stay alive?
Half your body weight?
Yeah, it's a little bit more than half your body weight, 40 kilograms to do all this stuff all the time. Pretty amazing. Okay. So that's the sliding filament model with what? Excitation, contraction, coupling, and all that kind of stuff. Okay, and some interesting kinds of receptors in the T-tubule. All right, so we're going to talk just a little bit about muscle contraction. This might be kind of a review from lab. If you guys start to look really bored, I'll just kind of skip over it, but I'll say a little bit about it. Now, this is interesting because we see a plot of tension versus time. So we're not measuring electrical activity. We're actually measuring force that's being produced by a muscle when it does what? When it contracts, right? And so, of course, it needs electrical events. It needs initial stimulation and release of calcium. And what I don't see on this diagram is where the stimulus is. But you know what? The stimulus has to precede muscle contraction. Then you have that latent period, which allows for excitation-contraction coupling to take place. So, and again, every single muscle fiber is going to contract to its maximal tension, okay, and then it's going to relax, right, when calcium is being pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But we can see graded contractions right here. For instance, if we increase the level of stimulation, increase the voltage, we might recruit more and more muscle fibers to contract. That's not what we're showing here on this slide. We're using the same level of stimulus. But if we apply two stimuli very close in time, right, so before the first twitch disappears, which is the contraction of the muscle, if we stimulate that muscle again, we certainly can, right, because the action potential has long gone already, right, it's going to contract, and the second contraction is, how could you describe the second contraction? It looks like it's about the same width, but it is a higher force of contraction. So there is summation that can take place in muscles. Now, how might you explain summation in muscles?
Frequency modulated.
Okay. Maybe. But what allows for myosin to actually grab hold of actin? It's calcium, right? So at this point in time, there's still some calcium left over inside the muscle cell, so there's still some association already. It hasn't already been pumped into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when another action potential comes by, there's some calcium that's left in the myofibril, and what do? You just pour more onto it, right? The more calcium you have inside the myofibril, the stronger force of contraction and the longer it will last, right? So summation is just due to an understanding of that excitation-contraction coupling mechanism, because by this time, calcium hasn't been all put away back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum yet. But once it has, like at this point in time, what can you tell me about that first twitch? It's about the same level as the first twitch over here. So the first twitch is going to have about the same level, and the second twitch is going to be enhanced because of summation, because of that residual calcium signal that's still left within the myofibril. Okay, but frequency has an important component to this, right? So here we can see two shocks given to a muscle really close together in time, right? So calcium levels are still relatively high in the myofibril by the time the second stimulus comes along, which means the second twitch is going to produce a stronger stimulus. And the third stimulus is going to produce even a stronger one because there's even more calcium left over inside the myofibril, on and on and on, until it reaches a plateau right here. And at this point, I would guess that probably all of the myosin head groups can attach themselves to the actin molecules. There's enough calcium inside the myofibril that they are going to produce this peak tension. All right, so at this frequency of excitation, 5 shocks per second, we call this incomplete tetanus. So tetanus is a condition in which a muscle contracts, but it doesn't relax. And so incomplete is somewhere in between, but mostly more where? Where it's completely contracted. All right, at 10 shocks per second, we see that there's still a little minimal amount of relaxation taking place, but the muscle basically is what, fully contracted, right? If there's any variation, we call that incomplete tetanus. But if the stimulation frequency is so fast, it's just going to cause the muscle to contract and stay contracted without any level of relaxation. We call that complete tetanus. All right, and then we see, even though the stimulation is still being applied, what happens to the force of contraction of this muscle? It starts to degrade, right? And you should probably have, and so we just call this fatigue. And how would you, what would you invoke to explain fatigue in this particular case? Let's just say you're stimulating a motor neuron, and then the muscle contracts, maximally stays contracted for certain plateau regions, but then starts to fatigue. What do you think might be breaking down? But you know what? I don't really know that you, I wouldn't expect you guys to know this. I ask you because I want to tell you. Okay. Because you might be thinking, well, maybe it's the neurotransmitter that's going away. Okay. Maybe the neuron can only release a finite amount of neurotransmitter. You know what? But the neuromuscular junction rarely runs out of neurotransmitter. What's happening here is that the myofibrils are actually running out of ATP. Okay? All right, so and when glucose is broken down, it produces lactic acid. All right, and lactic acid inhibits the myosin ATPase. All right, so the muscle runs out of energy, and also the pH changes, and that changes the whole thermodynamics for muscle contraction. And you should probably be able to tell me in your everyday experience, how did that feel? Did you ever have a muscle go into tetany?
Yeah.
Probably. Like if you maybe had a cramp in a muscle, it's just going to contract for whatever reason. Maybe that muscle was damaged, or maybe you didn't have proper diet, or who knows exactly why muscles go into tetany. But during that time, okay, how does it feel? Hurts like hell, right? Okay, so if I got a cramp in my biceps right here, it's going to contract. I wouldn't be walking around showing off my big biceps, how strong it was and well-formed and everything. What would I be doing? I would be crying, I'd be praying, I'd be dancing around, doing anything to get that muscle to relax, because when you start to build up lactic acid, that's very, very painful, right? And the reason why that happens, because when a muscle contracts, what does it turn into? It just turns into a solid, right? It goes from a tissue that could get perfusion, blood can flow into it, but when it contracts, blood can't flow into it. Doesn't mean that that muscle doesn't need ATP, it still does. It just means, it's getting sore already. It just means that it's running out of ATP. Okay, and then it should relax, and then it can reperfuse, and then it will come back to full life. All right, so anytime a muscle goes into spasm, right. For instance, when somebody gets blood supply cut off from their heart, can the heart just relax? Can it take a break? No, it's got to keep beating, even though it's not getting oxygen. All right, it's going to fatigue, but what else is going to happen? Well, it's going to hurt like hell, right? And as a matter of fact, it hurts so bad that a lot of people die of the pain. They give up when they have a heart attack, even one that they can recover from, because the pain is so severe. Yeah. So if somebody's having a heart attack, never do anything to promote their anxiety, because that might be enough to tip them over the scales. And there's evidence for that as well, right? Always be upbeat and tell them what? Relax, right? And let's get to a hospital and you can come back home tomorrow, hopefully. So get people to a hospital right away. I think we're going to talk a little bit about blood. There's a condition. There's a blood abnormality called sickle cell anemia, and that's a condition when somebody can't transport oxygen through their tissues because they have malformed hemoglobin, and their red blood cells get stuck in very, very tiny vessels. And guess what their muscles feel like when they're in sickle cell crisis? That's like you having a cramp. Okay, how does that feel all over their body? What did I say? Hurts like hell. Yeah, hurts like hell. Okay, so you've got to be really compassionate with people that are in chronic constant pain like that. How do we treat chronic constant pain? Opiates. Yeah, with opiates, right? And so And somebody with sickle cell disease, for instance, and you might think of other classes of patients, this is just a genetic condition that they have. It's not something that they can ever recover from. It's not anything that they did to themselves. But what do they need to live a normal life? They need opiates, right? So you kind of have to be aware of that a little bit, because a lot of times when you see the same patients over and over and over again that want opiates, what are you thinking? Well, you're thinking about protecting yourself more than helping them, because they might be a drug seeker and you never know what a drug seeker is going to do. But if they have a clinical foundation for that pathology, then, you know, you have to treat them with a lot of respect, and just like you and me, because they need that therapy. So don't ever treat them bad or withhold therapy from them or whatever when they're in that kind of crisis. Because how does it feel all over their body? Oh, just misery. But it doesn't just kill muscles. What would it kill? It would kill their heart, kill their brain, kill their kidneys. So it's a devastating disease throughout their whole body, right? So that's just sort of something to be aware of a little bit. Okay, let's talk about a length-tension relationship in muscle. This is going to be important not just for skeletal muscle, but for cardiac muscle as well. All right, the strength of muscle contraction is influenced by a couple of things that we saw: frequency of stimulation, the thickness of each muscle fiber. As a muscle fiber gets thicker, what can it have more inside of it? The organelles. What are those organelles called for contraction? Those are the myofibrils, right? So as you put more myofibrils inside of a muscle cell, it gets stronger because you have more sarcomeres, right, lined up from end to end, so a muscle gets stronger. All right, but here's one that's maybe not so intuitive until you take a look at it, and that is the initial length of the muscle fiber. It's the length of the muscle fiber when it starts to contract, or the length of a sarcomere when it starts to contract determines the tension that can be developed. All right, so the ideal resting length is that which can generate the maximum force. Okay, so I think the next slide kind of shows that. Okay, so this is what we call the length-tension relationship. So we have a plot of tension on the vertical axis versus percent resting length. So we're starting to stretch a muscle or let it relax and shorten a muscle and see what kind of tension that it can develop as a result of that. And we can see that it goes from an absolute minimum when the muscle is very, very short, and then it reaches an optimum. It gets stronger and stronger and stronger as we start to, stretch the muscle. And then as we stretch it too much, guess what happens? The tension disappears again. And we can actually have a pretty good intuitive feel for why that's happening by looking at how does a sarcomere contract again? What protein shortens?
None of them
shorten. They do what? They overlap. They slide over each other, right? So guess what? If they don't have any overlap, can they slide over each other? No, right? So that's one little foreshadowing of what we're going to talk about. All right, so right here, if the muscle is not stretched, the sarcomere is already shortened. The sarcomere is now the length of a myosin, right? So can this sarcomere shorten anymore?
No.
It's already completely shortened, right? So in order for this sarcomere to actually contract, what do we got to do? We got to stretch it out to leave some room for the filaments to slide over each other. And as we stretch them out, right, we reach a maximum. We see a nice overlap now between actin and myosin. There's still plenty of head groups here that can reach up and grab hold of this actin molecule, but there's still plenty of room so that the Z discs can be pulled into the M line right here. So under these conditions, this is the maximal contraction. And then if we stretch the muscle too much, now we don't have any overlap between the actin and myosin filaments. And even though there's a nice calcium signal that gets tropomyosin out of the way and plenty of ATP for cross-bridge cycling, myosin has nothing to grab hold of, and so the sarcomere is not going to shorten. So there is an optimal distance for every sarcomere. Okay, and that's really important in how we treat patients in cardiac failure, for instance, or hemorrhagic shock or something, because we can increase the force of contraction in the heart by what? Adjusting the volume of somebody's heart when it contracts. So if the heart is not stretched out, it's going to contract very weakly, or if it's too stretched out, it's going to contract weakly as well. So we'll get into that, I think, maybe in the next chapter. All right, so look at this. We call this the ascending limb of the length-tension relationship, producing this optimal region right here, and then this is the descending limb of the length-tension relationship when the sarcomere is too stretched out. So right smack in the middle where you have optimal overlap, that produces what? The maximal amount of tension. So can you see that little graphical analysis of overlap between actin and myosin? Okay, so that's one of the reasons why we talk about actin and myosin quite a bit. Okay, neural control. I don't remember anything to say about neural control. Okay. Well, for skeletal muscles, how many nerves does it take to go from central nervous system to a skeletal muscle? It just is one, right? Okay, just that somatic motor neuron. And that one is what we call a lower motor neuron because there are other motor neurons that come down from your brain, down the spinal cord. That's what we call an upper motor neuron. Okay. The lower motor neuron, sometimes we call the final common pathway. So its activity is influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons. So there's a part of your brain when you say, oh, I want to stand up right now because class is almost over. I want to stand up. There's a part of the brain that knows how much tension all of the different muscles, actually every single muscle in your body, needs to develop so that you stand up gracefully. Because when you stand up, you don't want to, like, jump on your neighbor or end up jumping over the desk, right? Okay, you stand up with an appropriate kind of tension developed by all these muscles, and appropriate so that you don't stand up and do what? Like, fall over. Okay, you stand up and maintain your balance. What part of your brain figures all that out while it's going on? Okay? Well, your cortex comes up with the information to say, I want to stand up, and you want to use some of these legs and things like that and postural muscles. But there's another part of the brain that knows how to stand up, and it adjusts the proper tension in all your muscles so that you do all that stuff right. That is the job of the cerebellum. Okay? So the cerebellum knows what the tension should be, okay, but in order for you to do it correctly, the cerebellum also has to know what? Not what it should be, but what the tension actually is, right? Because if a muscle doesn't produce what you think it should, there is what? An error, and then you're going to fall over or end up in somebody's lap or who knows what, right? So it's the job of the cerebellum to know what the tension of muscle should be, compare it to what it really is, and then do what? If there's an error, make a correction so that you kind of look normal when you're moving around, right? So that's the job of the cerebellum. So how does the cerebellum get information about the tension that's produced with muscles? And those are what we call proprioceptors. So there are proprioceptors that are sending tension information to the cerebellum all the time. And the cerebellum says, are you doing it correctly or incorrectly? And then it makes an adjustment if it's incorrectly. All right, so activity, muscle contraction is influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons and even joint capsules, right? And it's facilitated, and it could be inhibitory activity from upper motor neurons as well, because you still have what? Conscious control over all the different parts of your body. Okay, so control over skeletal muscle movements. Nervous system must receive continuous sensory feedback from proprioceptors. All right, and these we get from stretch of the muscle spindle apparatus. The muscle spindles are what are found in skeletal muscles, and they measure tension that are in muscles. And there are also Golgi tendon organs that measure tension in tendons. What's a tendon again? It's something that attaches a muscle to a bone, right? So it monitors the amount of tension that a muscle is actually being produced. So these are sending signals, tension information, to the cerebellum to perform that certain kind of motion. So where do you have muscle spindles? Here you have a muscle spindle in this muscle. This is where you're going to have the Golgi tendon organs, for instance. And the muscle spindles have things that look like muscle fibers on the inside of them, but they're very, very short. They don't produce tension. They just kind of shorten. These are the normal muscles right here that produce tension that you think of when you think of a normal muscle. So, and here you can see the motor end plate. So this is just a regular somatic motor neuron. We call this an alpha motor neuron. And it's going to, this is what we call an extrafusal fiber because it's outside the muscle spindle. The modified muscle cells inside the muscle spindle are called intrafusal fibers, and they have a different kind of innervation going to them. We call that a gamma motor neuron. Okay. So when you give your body a signal to contract a muscle, for whatever reason, you want to pick up a glass or a pencil or something, action potentials go down alpha fibers, but they also go down gamma fibers and cause the muscle spindle to contract a little bit. So we call that co-activation of the muscle spindle and the alpha motor fibers right here. They have to contract together. Okay, and then if for whatever reason something happens to that muscle and it starts to stretch inappropriately, oops, guess what happens? Where'd it go? Right here. Because of co-activation, since the extrafusal fibers, right, and the intrafusal fibers are at the same length, as soon as you start to stretch the skeletal muscle, guess what happens to the intrafusal fibers? They start to stretch as well. Right, so if the intrafusal fibers were really long and didn't have a lot of tension on them, you'd have to stretch the skeletal muscle a lot in order to produce tension on the intrafusal fibers. And so that wouldn't give you a whole lot of information. So these fibers have to maintain basically the same tension, right, so that when the skeletal muscle starts to stretch inappropriately, that can be monitored by these receptors. And I'm not going to ask you to know the kinds of receptors that you have right here and the two different kinds of intrafusal fibers, but you should at least know that these are the extrafusal, these are the intrafusal, right? They're activated together. And on the intrafusal fibers, you have sensory nerve fibers that are sending tension information basically to the cerebellum to see if that muscle is producing the right tension for whatever kind of activity that you're doing, right? Okay, so the alpha motor neurons go to the extrafusal fibers, the gamma motor neurons innervate the muscle spindle apparatus, and when the muscle spindle contracts, that increases the sensitivity to inappropriate stretch of a muscle, and it sends it through these sensory neurons right here. Okay, and you know what? I guess we got to go. So I'm going to start here, and I kind of talked about this. I'm going to start monosynaptic reflex after the test. Okay, so next time, what's the most important thing? No, a good eraser. A good eraser. Okay. Yeah, make sure you bring in a good eraser, pencil, and a Scantron. And your picture ID, please.